Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
Welcome back to Until Saturday. This is Ari Wasserman, joined by Bruce Feldman, the godfather of college football reporting. I don't know how to refer to you, but all I knew is I grew up admiring your work, and I still do, and I'm really happy that you're here.
Thank you, Ari. I appreciate that. That just means I'm really, really old, but let's get to it.
Yeah, really, really old, but a long history of excellence. We're going to talk a lot about the NFL draft today. Bruce is a college football insider, but he does a really, really good job during NFL draft coverage because he has so many sources close to programs and players. So he has an insight from the college level. I've always found that there's a distinction and a difference between the way that college football reporters view players and NFL draft prospects view players or analysts. And I'm excited to see what he learned about some of these guys. I have some questions about. We're going to whip around some spring game observations and maybe get to a few mailbag questions at the end if we have time. Be sure to follow the podcast on Apple wherever you listen to your podcasts. Please leave a 5-star review on that podcast. If you leave a question with that review, we'll do our best to answer it on the show. We appreciate your interaction and help of the growth of the show as much as you can. Also, leave us a voicemail on our Until Saturday phone line for future mailbag episodes. The phone number is 316-462-9852. Again, that is 316-462-9852. We always love to hear your wonderful voices. Your participation really adds to the show. My voice is very hoarse because I got sick over the weekend, so Bruce is going to do a lot of the heavy lifting.
How did you get sick, Ari?
I was in a casino for a long period of time, and I think that's what did it to me.
Define a long period of time for the listeners.
I was in a poker tournament, and I was there for about 15 hours straight.
15 hours. So you must have done pretty well if you were there 15 hours.
Yes. I played with my brother. We both made it to the final table. Felt really good. But I also, the rest of my weekend in Phoenix was ruined. So I'm back in Dallas now, and I'm super excited to get into the show. You did a mock draft, Bruce.
Just stay in Vegas for 1 second. So when you're at the table, do you get recognized by any of these people?
Never. Not once. Never? And I act like a complete asshole, too. So it's probably good that I don't.
Because I act, oh man, I just saw that guy go for 32-12 against the Lakers the other night. Now he's at the table.
Yeah. I am working really hard to no longer look like Jokic, but, Bruce and his family think I look like Nikola Jokic. And,
this is a cool thing. You look like the best basketball player in the world.
Yes. But that best basketball player in the world is far from a sex icon. I don't know.
He could slay in Serbia or in any part of Serbia.
Nikola Jokic had the amount of money that I had and he wasn't a star basketball player and just like was himself and even just bring his height down to around 5'11 because that's where I am. Do you think like if he went out, he would just have girls all over him all the time just because of what he looks like?
That is a good question. I would say yes.
Yeah. Okay. Then I'll take it. I'll take it. Bruce, you did a mock draft. What is your process like when you're going through it and how do you think it differs from the way that draft analysts do theirs, if at all?
So my whole premise is really I'm trying to get to the analysis and hopefully I have unique analysis in it, because my angle is always, for the mock draft I do, I'm going to talk to coaches who actually game plan for and coached against the players themselves. So it's not like when they look at film, they're like, even for the people who actually study film, they're not studying it necessarily from the perspective of that they coached against these players. They're not like, there's reasons why how they were trying to attack them, deal with them, everything. And I think that, to me, that's a unique perspective to have. It's not to say that there are certain guys who feel strongly that maybe this offensive alignment isn't as good as a lot of other people are projecting them to be, because they know what they went up against. It's not to say that they're going to be right and the player shouldn't get drafted as high and some of the draft guys are going to be wrong. I mean, I would probably say that there's probably a better chance of that because they have actual hands-on evidence of some of this stuff. But that's really how I go about it. I mean, the guy who, and I talked to him this year for some, the guy who was the most effusive about why CJ Stroud he thought was going to be much better than any other quarterback in that draft, certainly including Bryce Young, because he was so sold on never seen a quarterback as accurate downfield as CJ Stroud could do some of what CJ Stroud can do with the football. When I talked to him this year, it's like, I have a lot more, you know, not that I didn't have faith in him before, but I would trust him on quarterbacks as much as I would trust anybody on quarterbacks coming out of college because of his perspective on it.
And I think that maybe analyzing quarterbacks from the college level to NFL productivity is probably one of the more challenging things. I'm here right now willing to admit that I couldn't do it in a million years. Every time I think someone's going to be a star in the league, I feel like they're not. And then people, I'm like, what the hell's going on here? Turn out to be great.
I would ask you this. I would like not to jump you a little bit, but like,
go ahead.
Who would be a good example or two of somebody you were convinced was going to be great and wasn't, and somebody you thought was not going to be as good as and has been?
Okay. I was convinced that Justin Fields was going to be an NFL star. And that was because, and maybe, you know, I was too close to it because I covered every game he ever played in. But the combination of arm talent, physical talent, off the field traits that I saw, moments in big games, like everything that I saw from him in college lent me to believe successful quarterback in the NFL. And I don't know if that story is completely written yet, but he has already been moved on. Yeah, but when an NFL franchise moves on from you, whether it's an incompetent one or not, it's not a very good thing it's not a really good thing, what I thought. So, and the other question was, who did I think was not going to be very good and turned out to be really good? Justin Herbert. Really? I didn't know that his skill set in college would lend as well to the NFL as he did.
Did you ever see him in person, though?
I never watched him in person, not once. No.
Justin Herbert, when you see him in person, is like a tight end size guy who's really athletic, who is super smart and has an electric arm. They had a bowl game against Michigan State. I don't remember what they were. Maybe it was the Foster Farms Bowl. Maybe it was the Red Box, whatever they were calling it at the time. But like, he had one receiver who is not even like an NFL receiver. That's all they had. Now, they had some good offensive linemen, but it wasn't like he was throwing to what Michael Penix Jr. is throwing to. It's not like he was throwing what Caleb is throwing to. Certainly what Mac Jones was throwing to. He just didn't have a lot around him, I thought, at that point. The only hesitation I had on him was he's very thoughtful and cerebral, and you wondered, you know, how well will he command a locker room and some of those things. Not that you didn't think he could do it, but just how quickly could he transition. But to me, the physical tools were like almost off the charts in terms of that.
Yeah.
But Jeff, it helps to see him in person. It definitely.
And like, I am coming in with my hat in my hand, like admitting that being able to tell if someone's good in college, I think is a completely different skill set than being able to advance scout. And I think that it's so funny that there are people who do this full time and how low the hit ratio is. I mean, like I would have said, I probably wouldn't have taken Mac Jones where they did. And I think it's a lot easier to say someone's not going to be good and then them not be good because it's so hard to be great. And the bar to being an elite level quarterback in the NFL is so high. Even really productive players in the NFL aren't at that that place. So I think that's a good segue to talk about some of the NFL draft prospects based on their college football careers. And I've had this discussion a few times, and I want to start here. J.J. McCarthy. I've seen he has moved into the top five in every mock draft now, including yours. Help me, Bruce. What are people seeing with J.J. McCarthy that didn't strike me while he was playing in games in college?
One of the things that I think people are seeing is his athleticism and his ability to create plays and make them when you need them. Like, I think the thing with him a little bit was like, it was almost like in case of, you know, you break the glass in case you really need it. And you would see some of that, right? It was on, he played really well a year ago in a big situation. It was the payback game that Ohio State was supposed to have in Columbus. It was after Michigan had beat them for the first time. And I think a lot of people inside Michigan were like, yeah, everybody thinks this is a fluke. We're going to get our butts kicked. And remember, he wasn't the starter that year. That was Caden McNamara. And I think he had emerged as a real leader in the team at that point. They went into that game. He really had no Blake Corum. He barely could play. Donovan Edwards, who went off in the fourth quarter, but was playing with a soft cast on his hand. You know, their most dynamic receiver at that point turned out to be a freshman from Idaho, Colston Loveland. And they were on the ropes, and he went in there, and he led them to that win. He made some big throws when they needed it, made some big plays. And so I think you see some stuff. You just don't see the body of throws that you see from Penix or Caleb, but you see a lot of the guy. It's interesting because the guy that, I have a story coming out Tuesday. It's like a draft confidential where now I'm talking to the other side of it, where it's the NFL coaches and the NFL position coaches, scouts. And a person who he's been compared to quite a bit in this is Drake May, because they're both on the younger side, right? And they're actually the two guys who in the first round chatter didn't transfer, everybody else transferred. They didn't. Now, Drake May is different in that he had two different, pretty different systems from Phil Longo to Chip Lindsey. Whereas, there was different quarterback coaches for JJ, but there was continuity. But in terms of both guys, I feel like are a little more on the developmental side than what you probably have from Jaden Daniels, what you have, I think, even from Penix and certainly from Caleb. Drake May, the people I talk to think is going to have to take some time to develop, clean up his footwork. Both guys, I heard, made big strides from what people saw of what they saw on film consistently compared to what they saw from their pro day. They got really high marks. Usually you hear that, everybody did great in pro day if you're a quarterback. But I do think I buy some of the stuff that people I talked to who are quarterback coaches said, no, they thought that a lot of stuff was cleaned up from them. Again, pro day is a very sterile setting, so it should be clean. But he has a good arm. There's great leadership skills. He's really football smart, and he's really athletic. If there's some pause on JJ on the film, it's like a lot of it seems to be a one speed pitcher on what they see, where everything's kind of like, looks like it's more of a rocket shot throw as opposed to, layering the ball in. And you want, people want to see more than that. He had a tendency to overstride a lot, but he can throw over guys and throw around guys, but they didn't see enough of that. And I think both he and Drake May are very interesting evaluations for that regard. I think Drake May is really polarizing. I think among the NFL draft world inside, and I think JJ is polarizing among college football fans because he didn't put up big numbers, but he just won a lot of games.
Yeah, I think that the intangible aspect of this is interesting because, listen, Brock Purdy just played in the Super Bowl and led a team all the way there. And I don't know that if you turned on the film in college that you would see, well, that guy's going to play in a Super Bowl one day. He was very good and very productive on a team that wasn't loaded with talent. But even for Iowa State, they had quite a bit of good players. But like when I watch Drake May play in college, like my eyeballs pop out of my head. Like I watch the plays that he's making and I'm just like, this guy is next level brilliant. And J.J. McCarthy is a consistent winner and took Michigan to a height that I would have thought, as you know, was impossible a year ago. But I don't when I watch him, I think he's an effective player. I think he makes clutch plays in important moments. But like when it comes to being a successful NFL quarterback, you need to have the dynamic ability to make any throw on the field. There are so many different aspects to this that I just didn't really see because Michigan ran the ball 26 times in a row when they were in a close game this year. And maybe it's just I don't see it and he'll turn out to be a 15-year Pro Bowler. But like I thought that Drake May was going to have a chance to be the first overall pick in the draft 6 months ago. And now he's in the J.J. McCarthy camp and not in the Caleb Williams camp. And it's all just so interesting to me because the way I think it goes just never goes the way I think it's going to go.
Yeah, it doesn't mean Drake May can't have a great NFL career. I just think people, you know, I've talked to feel like his footwork, on film was kind of all over the place. And there was just an inconsistency as he was trying to learn another system. I mean, one of the coaches I talked to said, in his experience with him, he kind of felt like he was jumpy around the pocket and didn't handle pressure the same way that Sam Howell did, and said, there was some concerns on that. Now, another coach I talked to thought Drake May had really good pocket presence. So, I don't know if it's beauty is in the eye of the holder or the different challenge brings out. I mean, you're still talking about really young quarterbacks. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, the thing that, you keep going back to is, the NFL studies this has way more information than certainly like the recruiting guys do. And mm-hmm. they still get it wrong 50, 60% of the time on top quarterbacks. And I did a story that went up this morning on the Bears, and it was with our Bears writer, Kevin. And it was about the perspective from one NFL quarterback coach, and then as well as some of the layers of what goes on about like, no one questions Caleb Williams' talent. What there is some question marks is how well is he going to fit and get nurtured in the Bears system and what they have in the quarterback room. And what I don't think a lot of people realize is how critical like the ecosystem around the young quarterback is in the mm-hmm. NFL. There's tons of guys who are great college quarterbacks who for whatever reason bombed in the NFL. And if they were in a different situation, maybe they wouldn't, but like Patrick Mahomes went from 10th pick in the draft to he will be a first ballot Hall of Famer if he never plays another down. He's 28. He's already won 3 Super Bowls, 3 MVPs. And what I think people may forget a little bit is he went into a perfect situation. He sat behind Alex Smith, who was a well-respected veteran quarterback, kind of was able to observe. Then he has Andy Reid running everything, right? He also has like an all-time tight end that's a great security blanket, right? Like he's obviously a great talent and he's fit great and he's, it's been awesome all the way around. But there are certain guys who go into just brutal situations and then they're constantly digging out of a hole or they get ruined. Mm-hmm. Sam Darnold has been I would have thought Sam Darnold would have been a better NFL quarterback than he's been. He went to the Jets and he just completely seemed like he was broken there. He famously made the comment on Monday Night Football. It's like, I'm seeing ghosts. That's, it's a bad place to be for a young quarterback. And then how do you build them back up? He's on his at least third team now. And, who knows how many more chances you get. It doesn't mean he can't be around the NFL for 12 years, but Zach Wilson's another guy, really good arm talent. Had a really good college career, and then the Jets, it fell apart. And I'm not saying it's just the Jets, but like, there's no.
It's interesting because Chicago would probably be in that same camp, though. Yeah.
Now they're teeing it up again. They had your guy, Justin Fields, and now they're going to have Caleb. And Caleb's going to have better talent around him than Justin Fields did. I mean, he's got 2 elite receivers and a very good tight end. And they drafted a really good offensive tackle in the top 15 last year, so there's a lot to work with. But, as we get into the story that we did, it's like, he's not got Alex Smith in the quarterback room. He's got a free agent who was a rookie last year from a small school. And then he has got Brett Rippon. And that's, it's a different. Now, the flip side is, Justin Fields had a really experienced quarterback in the room, and that seemed to go the opposite way. So, it's It's going to be interesting to see how it works for Caleb.
When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. LinkedIn isn't just a job board. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. On LinkedIn, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Hire professionals like a professional on LinkedIn. LinkedIn knows that small businesses are wearing so many hats, it might not have the time or resources to hire. LinkedIn is constantly finding ways to make the process easier. They even just launched a feature that helps you write job descriptions, making the process even easier and quicker. 2.5 million small businesses use LinkedIn for hiring, and it's time you join that number. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/CFB23. That's linkedin.com/CFB and the numbers 23 to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
There's one other prospect that I find to be fascinating, and then I want to ask you a few of your under-the-radar guys. But Brock Bowers is somebody who I think anybody who's followed college football has seen an incredible amount of production from and is a freak. We're 2 or 3 years removed from the best tight end prospect that we've seen in my lifetime, I think, maybe, or one of them, in Kyle Pitts, who was taken to the top 10 and has been very unproductive in Atlanta. Maybe that'll change. It's still early in his career. But what is it outside of the obvious, maybe, Bruce, in your reporting that makes Brock Bowers a shoe-in top 10 pick? And how does he differ from maybe the situation that Kyle Pitts was in?
Well, hopefully for his sake, he will have a much better quarterback. Like if he goes to the Jets and Rodgers healthy, then yes. I could go, you know, like if he went to the Falcons now, which obviously he won't, but like now you have Kirk Cousins as opposed to young Desmond Ridder, right? So there's that. The Bowers is interesting. He was a dominant offense. I would argue he's the best offensive player of the Kirby Smart era. There's been a ton of elite players, but Bowers is different, and he was such a playmaker. And you watch the Auburn game, they look like they could lose that game, and he took it over. You know, he's terrific with the ball in his hands. He's very athletic. And one of the coaches, like, he's got that clutch gene. He just steps up and he responds. And he's just a really terrific football player. The downside on him and why, you know, I think he'll go in the top 10, but why he might not is when coaches see him, they're like, ooh, he's a little smaller than I thought. You know, like tight ends, he's an F. He's not like your typical, he's not your prototypical tight end. Like Kyle Pitts, that's what they look like. You want to look 6'6", and he's big, and he's more dynamic. Bowers is 6'3 and change, and he's 245. He's a smaller tight end. He's not as fast as Evan Engram. Evan Engram is similar size, you know, as another F, you know, a 12 personnel guy. And, you know, take your slot off the field and this guy's going to be it. You know, Evan Engram's is a little straight line faster. I think Bowers is a tougher player, but I'm interested to see, does he go? Cause I thought Pitts would go in and crush it.
Yeah. Again,
not shocking considering it was the Falcons offense and, you know, especially on what's your quarterback's guy to ask somebody, and again, you kind of hate doing this when it's like, oh, this is another white tight end or whatever. But one of the coaches I talked to, we were talking about like how different the football is now than it was. Like there's a comparison. This is a good one, you know, if it's the way it is, of I think he could be Shannon Sharp. Shannon Sharp's a Hall of Fame tight end, but it was a different era of how they tried to cover Shannon Sharp. Same thing now that you like, I asked about like one of the tight ends who was a great chess piece for the Cowboys was Jay Novacek, but it was like Jay Novacek was like 2 inches taller, maybe faster. I don't know where, you know, may not have the same kind of range that Novacek had. And also like now that you're getting covered, tight ends are like that are getting covered by a nickel as opposed to like a walked out linebacker or, you know, like they throw safety out there. So now, teams have a better way of trying to deal with that kind of piece than they did in the 90s or in probably in Sharp's day. So, but you know, the fact that both those guys are, you know, one guy's a Hall of Famer, one guy's was a great player on great teams. So, I'll be surprised if he's not an extremely productive player and worth a top 15 pick.
Bruce, who were, through your reporting and maybe just your eyes too, do you think are undervalued players that have a pretty high ceiling in the league, but might not be in the top five?
Might not be in the top five
or top 10 or whatever. Not the prototypical. Yeah. I think, you know, Jaden Daniels is going to be good type of thing.
Yeah, I get you. You know, there's a few guys that I think one's interesting is like this is a really, really deep crop of receivers
mm-hmm.
in terms of like what you get. You know, you have three receivers who I think are much better than any receiver was in this past draft. You know, it just was like Jaxon Smith-Njigba was first off the board at 20. All three of these guys are, I think, much better than what, you know, potentially than what he was. Ricky Pearsall is a receiver from Florida who started out at Arizona State. Super tough kid, has really good hands, tested great. I could see him going somewhere in the second round and turn out to be a really good NFL receiver. I think, you know, it's not like he had a great situation at Florida, but I think he's really, really good. You can see, you know, can do some double moves. He's physical. He's the kind of guy that the Rams have had a lot of success with.
Yeah.
Well, in terms of that, he's not as big as Puka, but he's not, you know, he's not a tiny receiver. I think he's really, really talented. You know, that would be one that certainly comes to mind. And then when you start getting into the other side of the ball, I feel like, you know, Kentucky has a DB, Andrew Phillips, who's really smart, really athletic, can do a lot of stuff. And to some degree, I think in the SEC, a lot of the attention, and rightly so, went to the two Alabama corners, Kool-Aid and Terry on Arnold. But I mean, this guy's a really, really good player. And it's not a, you know, it's not a bad group of corners, but he's one I would say keep an eye on if you're just talking about in, you know, after the first round, if he goes after the first round.
This has got to be the deepest receiver draft that, I mean, I think last year, just if you were watching college football, there were so many teams that just had elite level guys. But like, I think about second round receivers and it's like Keon Coleman's a second rounder. Like Keon Coleman was an incredible player in college. What about Ladd McConkey?
Just doesn't run fast.
But yeah. Keon
Coleman is a really tough kid, makes a lot of contested catches. I think he is a really good player. He's a really good player. There's a layer of guys like that. Xavier Leggett is a big, muscled up. You know, he's had some injuries, had a motorcycle accident, but he's fast. He's a great special teams player. Like, I think he's somebody people keep an eye on who can really play. You have two guys from Texas who are both
mm-hmm.
blazing fast. One obviously, and Xavier Worthy is the fastest guy the combine officially has ever had, and he's a guy that people have really good reports out of Texas in terms of like great practice player, much tougher than people normally think of with a guy who's just a speed guy, because he's more than just a speed guy. He will be physical and throw his body around. The other one, A.D. Mitchell, I think people think there's high level talent there, they just worry about the consistency, but he's 6'2", 205. And he's super smooth and he's got, you know, got really good bursts. It's just a matter of like the consistency. You see it there. You got a guy, Brian Thomas, who's, you know, basically the same size as Marvin Harrison Jr., but is legit 4.33 speed. Now he's not as polished, but I think there's a lot of people who are very high on him. It is a really loaded group of receivers. And I think,
and that Malachi Corley kid too, right, Bruce? Yeah. He was really, really good.
He is, you know, he's 6 feet or 215. There's some Debo comparisons to him. I think some people are, you know, some of the people I talked to think he's gotten a little overblown. He was at Western Kentucky, really, really good with the ball in his hands. Great after the catch. I think he's going to be a really good player. Now, most people I talked to think he is. There's one I talked to who was like, I don't get it. I don't see him as a top 3 round guy. It was just like, you know, but I think he's really intriguing player because you're seeing how teams use guys like that. And I think he gives you that dimension.
The thing I love about the NFL draft prep is one person will compare him to Deebo Samuel and another person will say, I don't get it. And it's just like beautiful. Let me ask you this, Bruce. Do you think that with all the things that these NFL scouts and draft analysts have at their disposal and the just excess of information about personality type and are they a team player and what do they get on the Wonderlic or do they paint their nails or what, all these different things that everybody's considering, that at times just watching the tape in college and just like seeing who was really productive doesn't get as much notice or as much attention as it should, or takes a back seat in certain areas? Or do you think that that's just a crazy thought?
No, I think, look, there's a player who has as good a film probably as anybody on defense in the draft, and that's Peyton Wilson. I would argue he's the best defense player in the country. But Peyton Wilson's like medical history of shoulder and knee injuries, you know, really scares some teams. And this is a guy who's 6'4", 230 plus, ran 4.43 and made a ton of big plays. Like his coach at NC State, the DC, Tony Gibson, thinks he's the best defensive player he's ever been around in 30 years of football. Linebackers are a little bit like running backs in terms of like, if he came along 10 years ago or 15 years ago with a clean bill of health, he might be a top 10 pick. He doesn't have really long arms, but he can run like the wind and he's physical and he's smart and he's super tough. And now teams are talking about, you know, can you get him through his first contract? Meaning like, if you can get that, what they think he could do. And look, if he goes to like a team like the 49ers, he's a great scheme fit. He may make 150 tackles. You know, he's like that guy. But, you know, I think there was probably at least four guys I talked to coaches about in the last month where they might say, and they're like, yeah, he's not on our board. Either it's a kid who everybody hated in their Zoom meeting and just thought, okay, this is not a guy we want to coach. Or there's character issues to the point where I remember I would like text Dane Brugler, our draft guru, and be like, hey, what is exactly the, like, because I was going to write exactly what the character, like, I wasn't probably going to, like, if it's a player who's really getting, you know, dinged, there's one in particular I can think of, on the character part, I was just curious what it was, like, because it was something that, you know, I've seen people write about a certain, you know, people who cover a given team, you know, they write about somebody who tested really well at the combine, and I'm like, yeah, I don't know if they, like, this guy's not on people's draft boards, a handful of people's draft boards because of certain character issues that, like, I didn't know about.
Okay, Bruce, let's go through the spring a little bit and take 2 or 3 minutes on a few teams here. Let's start with Oklahoma. Jackson Arnold connected with the Purdue wide receiver transfer, Deion Burks, for a 64-yard touchdown right out of the gate of the OU spring game. Burks ended up with 174 yards. This is a Oklahoma team that's had some elite level receivers in the past. CD Lamb, DD Westbrook, Marvin Mims, to name a few. Is Oklahoma, if Jackson Arnold figures it out, every bit as prepared for the SEC as maybe even Texas? Or am I overstating things a little bit?
I think they're in a good place from this standpoint. I feel like they are riding a little bit under the radar. Like they're going in with Texas, but everybody, because Texas, and rightly so, Texas is coming off going to the playoff and coming within like a play of going to the national title game. I would argue Jackson Arnold's every bit as talented, maybe even more so than yours. Now he hasn't played as much, but he is a big time quarterback. I like some of the coaching, you know, I think Seth Luttrell will be a good addition for them at OC. You know, he obviously was a good player under Bob Stoops and he was a good offensive coordinator. And then he became a head coach. He was back there last year as an analyst. He's really close to Bill Beedenbaugh, the O-line coach there. So I think that'll be a great fit. They had some good players stay. They, as you mentioned with Burks, they added some good players in the portal. And again, the flying under the radar piece, like, I didn't know what to expect from them last year because they had a really kind of a disappointing first year under Venables. and they stepped up. And look, some of that, I think, you know, you had Dylan Gabriel, who I think is a really good college quarterback, but now you have this really talented young quarterback who has some seasoning, I think is in a good system fit. And I feel like the hype will be managed somewhat because Texas is going to get a lot of it, you know? And for people who are going, oh, who's going to, you know, Nick Saban's, you know, step down and what's this league look like now? I just think there's something to be said for this is probably a good transition year for them because of Texas is going to get a lot of the attention.
Yeah. And also too, I think when, you know, just casual fans think about Oklahoma, they think about leaky defense and they return a lot of defensive production, you know, with linebacker Danny Stutzman and defensive lineman Ethan Downs. Billy Bowman, the cornerback, was a highly rated prospect, and they're adding a five-star defensive tackle in David Stone, who was at IMG and originally from Oklahoma. It seems to me like they could have a pretty good defense too. So I'm excited to see how Oklahoma does. Okay, let's go to Duke. You're a Miami guy. You went there. But when you look at Manny Diaz's regime at Miami, what can he learn from that experience at Duke? And are you all in on Malik Murphy mania?
Manny's a very smart guy. I think Miami was a tough situation because he was the best thing of the Mark Richt run at Miami. Manny's defense was very good and opportunistic, and he gave them back some identity. Miami had kind of lost it for a long time. And then when he ended up taking the job, I thought he did some good things. But ultimately, you know, the specter of we can get Mario Cristobal in here was just, I think, was looming over there. And you had a lot of people who, fair or unfair, right or wrong, just did not believe in Manny. He did a very good job as Penn State's DC. And I do think, like I said, I think he's really smart. I think the fit at Duke is good. They obviously have had success with defensive guy with Elko. We'll see about Malik Murphy. I like him personally. We had been around him through the Elite 11. He's a really likable, bright young kid. He's enormous. The issue with him, like I was at Texas K-State, that was a game he started, was can he get rid of the ball? You know, is he holding it on too long? Because, you know, unfortunately for him, he's not played a lot of football. You know, he was in the, you know, in high school during COVID and just got robbed of some time and playing. You know, he played a little bit at Texas. So we'll see. I mean, I could see why he would be a big recruit because he's a huge guy who has a really good arm, who's really bright and very likable. It's just, you know, it's quarterback is a position where you need a lot of live reps. And he hasn't had that many of them. So I don't want to say when you ask me, am I all in? I'm curious. I'm not skeptical, but I just know quarterback's position where, you know, I don't care if you're a five-star or a three-star, if you haven't played a lot of it in actual games, you know, that's where people get over their skis on stuff.
It's funny because there is a little bit of that NFL draft excitement from my end when it comes to him because of the recruiting process. But whenever I see somebody who's as enormous as he is, and you and I think, saw him at the Elite 11 3 years ago together when he was still a raw player who hadn't played much in high school. And then I saw him at the Elite 11 regionals last summer in Austin, and I didn't even recognize him because of how big he got. Like, I was like that, like it was a year or maybe 2 years in between when we saw him together, and he was like twice the size of even that. So when you think about like physical traits and arm strength, like that to me is stuff that NFL draft people get excited about. And I'm very curious to see like how far he can stretch that at Duke. The big story of the weekend was at Texas. Arch Manning apparently looked like Dan Marino in his prime. I don't know if you caught a glimpse of that, but he had 350 yards passing and 3 touchdowns. And Isaiah Bond had a pretty big play. I know that he's not going to be playing most likely this year, but what is your view on Texas and Arch Manning's future? That's a pretty big question.
It is a big question. Yeah, I think Arch sounds like he's really coming along. I know they like him. I would imagine, you know, like yours has got hurt each of the last 2 years. So maybe he gets in for a couple of games in that kind of situation. you know, I don't think there was like, not to drop names, but a few months ago, I remember I did Rich Eisen's show and he had asked me a lot about Arch and like yours is coming back as if it was a shock and, you know, like, what does this mean for Arch? Will he leave or the Mannings of this? And I just remember thinking, I was like, first of all, I'm not shocked that Quinn Ewers would come back because I don't think anyone was looking at him as a first round pick, especially in this, you know, deep draft.
Yeah.
Second of all, you pick Texas for a reason. If you're Arch Manning, where are you going to go? That's going to be a better fit down the road. Cause it's not like, you know, all of a sudden you're going to play one great year wherever you transfer and then you could leave for the NFL anyway. So I think he's like, keep working, keep developing. I try to pump the brakes on, like, Stu and I are a little opposite of this. Stu sees a spring game and is running down chasing the mailman, you know, like he's the dog, you know, take it with a grain of salt. Like, I like to watch spring games and I like to hear the chatter about what, like, the coaches and have told maybe the broadcast crew that's in there, but it's not, you know, like, we've seen a lot of guys over the years had breakout games in spring games and done very little in the fall. I'm not saying that's going to be Arch. I think there's a lot of stuff to like there, but I try not to get too caught up in spring games at this point.
Yeah. I think that there's like a happy medium between those two things. It's like the entire like spectrum of following college football is getting excited about the future. And it starts with recruiting. And then when a young player gets in and he looks the part, it feeds the hype machine. But I also know too, that they are just practices and it's one practice.
Yeah. You were at Elite 11 last year, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was very impressed by Julian Sain. Very, mm-hmm. very impressed. And he was the quarterback from Calabasas who went to, wait a minute, from Calabasas? He's from Southern California.
He's from San Diego.
Yeah. He's not from Calabasas. I keep doing that. He's from Carlsbad, not Calabasas.
Two places, by the way, that I would very much like to live one day. So from that sense, you're right.
Yeah. So, but I thought he looked so good, like, to, you know, everything. But it's, you know, that too, similar to a spring game, it's not entirely real. They try to make it as real as possible. But anyway, and I knew people, I know people who working at Ohio State, they really like what they've seen from him in the spring. I don't think he had in the spring game, he may have thrown a pick or two. And it was just like, it's not the, oh, he put up like this gaudy stat line in the Buckeyes spring game or anything like that. And, you know, I wouldn't be like, oh, you know, like, part of it is, hey, you're going to make some mistakes, especially, you know, they have talent on defense and everything. And it's a big stadium. It's the first time you're in the big stadium for a game like that. So I don't know. I just think I get what you're saying. It's just, I'm also mindful. Sometimes you see a guy at their best in a spring game. And sometimes it's like, they're not showing that much or whatever. So I get what you're trying to get for the happy medium though.
Florida State's a pretty interesting place because Mike Norvell has probably been, I know that Lane Kiffin is called the portal king a lot, but Norvell has done a really good job in not just getting a lot of players, but hitting on those players. You know, they did lose some important pieces from last year's team, all of whom were big time transfers.
They're Jared stars. Versus, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Stars.
Jordan Travis from Louisville. You mentioned Keon Coleman, Johnny Wilson. Mm-hmm. You know, their tight end Jaheim Bell was really good. Verse from Albany was terrific. You know, Braden Fisk from Western Michigan was great. There's more than that. Like, they, you're right. Like, no, I feel like nobody was better at hitting on transfers. Like, Fisk was better at Florida State than he was at Western Kentucky.
And Trey Benson also too, the running back, really from good transfer.
Yeah.
So how do you view Florida State's program now after, you know, having a pretty unfortunate finish to last year's season? And is that something that Florida State can do consistently? Because it's like not just hitting on the portal, but getting stars, as you mentioned. Like, is that a good plan for consistent production at a place like that? And what do you anticipate Florida State looks like this year?
I think so. I think he's a terrific coach. Like, I'm a believer in him. I think he's really good. He's really smart. He's good offensively. He's put together a really good staff. I'd be surprised if they're not going to, you know, recruit well on the high school side and, you know, I don't know how many, you know, I know there's people know this, but like that program was in bad shape when Jimbo left. The offensive line room was terrible. You know, Willie Taggart got there and he couldn't get it going. And then Norvell came in. Alex Atkins is an O-line guy. That guy did a terrific job. They, you know, I said this ad nauseum. I thought they deserved to be in the playoff last year. And I think they're going to be like, I'm very interested to see how DJ does there. You know, DJ has some ups and downs at Clemson. You know, we did this big story with him last year around this time where he was very candid with The Athletic about, you know, how things went at Clemson and some of the challenges. He had some good moments at Oregon State, but let's see what happens in this offense, right? You know, I think to me, they were a legit top five team last year. I don't know if they're a top five team now, but I don't also, like, I think they're a top 15 kind of team. So, and I think they will be, to me, they're going to be a top 15, top 10 kind of team as long as Mike Norvell's there.
Yeah, and they're going to be a little bit more active too in the spring portal window. I believe they had to sit out last week for serving an NIL violation punishment with Amarius Mims. It'll be interesting to see what they do there. Greedy Vance transferred to USC this week, so they've got some spots they've got to attend to. Okay, here's my favorite one I've been looking forward to all morning to talk to you about. Michigan. Because you and I were on different ends of the spectrum around this time last year and heading into the season. You were right. I was wrong. I'm ugly. You're incredibly attractive. No, like, no, I don't know. Like,
you look like a doppelganger, albeit a foot shorter, of the best basketball player in the world. There's no ugly there.
Yeah. What do you think? Are we overlooking how good they actually can be this year? I think there's a lot of people who are just, well, they lost a big chunk of what made them great last year. There's a coaching change. A lot of production is gone. But there is, you know, even in the face of roster turnover, a large bulk of their young playmakers return. They're in the running for players like the defensive tackle CJ West, like from Kent State. Sharon Moore's offense is here. Like, what do you think of Michigan and at the quarterback position, especially with a guy like Alex Orji potentially? Could they be a lot better than people are giving them credit for?
They can be. Going into the spring, I was like, all right, I think they're like an 8-4 kind of team. Because they lost a ton off that team, not just head coach Jim Harbaugh, also Ben Herbert, the strength coach, who is a huge piece in their development. And here's what they do have that I like. That I think they have one of the best D-lines in college football. I mean, Kenneth Grant is a dominant player. They have like some dominant dudes in there. They added one of the most talented defensive players in the Big Ten. From Maryland, who I think will help them at linebacker and can get after the quarterback too and give them that. You have an elite cornerback in Will Johnson. It hurts them not to have Rod Moore, who's one of the better DBs in the Big Ten. But they can, you know, they can, I think they have some good young talent there. Offensively, you lose almost the entire offensive line. I mean, they have guys who have played a decent amount, but I think they will get that rebuilt. It can't be as good. I know you're bringing in a transfer from Northwestern who started almost 30 games, but I just think the continuity and all that there's a little drop off there. Loveland's back. Obviously Donovan Edwards back. Mm-hmm. I don't, you know, maybe Orji is the guy. Davis Warren looked really, really good yesterday. And I know Kirk Campbell thinks very highly of Davis Warren's arm talent. People can get hung up on, oh, this guy came in as a walk-on, but he has a really unique story just in that, you know, he overcame leukemia. He was the backup 2 years ago, you know, so he's a talented kid. He can really throw the football. Like I said, he's a guy, anybody who overcomes something like what he had to overcome, I wouldn't pick him. And they're not going to ask whoever the quarterback is. They are not going to ask him to go do what Michael Penix did last year.
They didn't ask their first round top five pick quarterback to do it last year. Yeah.
They've never asked. I mean, you have to go back to like Denard and they asked him to do different stuff when you ask somebody to carry an offense, you know? So maybe they can, I don't know if they can win 10 games. That seems like a lot to me. but they have talent on defense. I mean, I think they can be very good in their front, you know, especially linebackers, defensive line. I think they can get after people. And if you're really good there and you're really smart with how you manage it. And again, Donovan Edwards, he did not have a great year last year, but you know, you watched that Ohio State game in Columbus 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And he's a really good receiver out of the backfield. You have two tight ends. You may have three tight ends that are really good. So the cupboard is not bare. I just think, you know, to me, if I was ranking what the Big Ten is looking like, I'm like, I think you have 1A and 1B and Ohio State and Oregon. Then I feel like you have a little gap where maybe Penn State is. And then I think in this like cluster there, it's like Wisconsin, Iowa, Michigan. But maybe Michigan isn't as far off as I think, just because, again, I thought you lost a lot of veteran leadership in that group. It's Sain Ristil, great player, great leader. Barrett, really good player, big leader on defense. And then on the offense, it's Zinter, obviously JJ, Corum. I mean, that's a lot to replace.
This is a program that you live near. USC, Lincoln Riley endorsed Miller Moss as a front runner for the starting quarterback position after a strong spring. The defense, though, has been kind of the leading talking point. They have a new defensive staff there. They've brought in some transfers. Can USC's defense be passable this year? Not great. I think that would be too much to ask. But do you think they can be good?
I think they can be okay. My hunch is Danton Lynn, who came across town from UCLA, actually had better talent in the front seven in Westwood than he will here at USC. I mean, remember, he had Laiatu Latu, who was the best D lineman in the country last year. He had the Murphy twins, who are really good college players. He had a couple linebackers. Darius Muasau was a really good college linebacker. And right now, you have some guys who have some talent, but I don't know, you know, they were horrible the last couple of years. So there's that. You know, Caleb was a wild ride last year. I mean, they're still a 7-win team. I think Miller Moss can be good. Like, I think he is smart and accurate, and I think they will play hard for him. And I could see Lincoln Riley's really good at playing to people's strengths. You know, the negative, I mean, Zachariah Branch is as explosive as you get, and he'll give you that special teams, and he'll definitely give you that on, you know, and Lincoln will showcase it. But the offensive line was really suspect last year. It'll probably be a little better. I'm not sure it's going to be that much better. And I don't, you know, I just don't think they have like upper level, USC type talent around. Branch is special, but I don't know. In the first year in the Big Ten, like,
if they don't make the playoff, I owe Andy Staples $1,000. Am I dead?
You serious?
Yeah.
You made that bet?
Well, I made it that they would make it. I made it 2 years ago, and I said they would make it within the first 3 years. And I was half away in year one, but now I'm like, I thought I was cashing immediately, and now it looks really dire for me.
It does look dire. I mean, the good thing is the playoff is 12 teams.
The bad thing is they can't stop anyone. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not just that. I mean, it's like, you know, you're moving into a new league. I just think there's a lot of challenges that are going to come with, okay, now all of a sudden that, like, I'm just looking at trying to look up their schedule now, because it's like, it's a heavy lift because of the travel piece of it. You know, you go through it. I mean, can they go 8-4 and make the playoff? I wouldn't feel great about that it's $1,000 in a hole. So they're going to play LSU. It's a neutral site. There'll be a lot of LSU people there. That's a toss up at best. Then they have Michigan, you know, they play Utah State, should win that at Michigan. I don't think that's a great matchup for them. They get Wisconsin at home, at Minnesota, Penn State is at home. Got to go all the way over to play Maryland, at Washington, Nebraska, UCLA, Notre Dame. At least like a lot of these games are at home. You know, if you're going to make the, you know, Michigan's not that bad of a road trip in terms of when you fly to Detroit, it's not like you have two East Coast, full-on East Coast trips. I mean, they do got to go to Maryland, but I don't think Maryland's going to be that good this year. I don't know.
You know what scares me is I look at the schedule and I don't think that I can circle more than three games that are guaranteed wins.
I know. I mean, I would circle Utah State.
Yep.
Man, Maryland's a long trip. I think Rutgers is actually is a mid-level Big Ten team, but that's a long trip for Rutgers.
Yeah.
You know,
do you think that the cross country flights, you know, maybe not the first time they do it, but by like week eight, if they're still doing it, are going to have a major impact on performance? Like those body clock games. Do you think it's going to be a big deal for them?
I do, because I just think it's like you're getting kids out of rhythm a lot. And it's like some of these, you know, Nebraska's relatively close for them, you know, like Rutgers, they get them home. You know, it's based, and you don't have to go to Penn State. They come here. You know, it's some of these trips are more manageable. You know, Minnesota, obviously, Nebraska is that way. You know, it's the Maryland trip is long. You know, the Michigan trip is not great, but
doing it at Michigan every other week, at Michigan, at Minnesota, at Maryland, like that's a lot of 4 hour, 5 hour, 6 hour flights. And maybe some weather conditions that they're not accustomed to as well. So it'll be interesting to see how they manage that.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways to me, UCLA gets a way worse deal. UCLA has to go to Penn State, which is a brutal trip. And then 2 weeks later has to go to Rutgers, which is a long trip. And somewhere like before they do the Penn State, like 2 weeks before they go to Penn State, they got to go to Baton Rouge.
Yeah, that's brutal.
UCLA has a way worse situation than USC.
Yeah. Bruce, let's go to a few more real quick. South Carolina, what do you think are real expectations for Shane Beamer this year? Lenora Sellers will likely be the first-time starter since Spencer Rattler is off to the NFL now. The SEC is obviously way more overcrowded than it's been in the past with Texas and OU, but South Carolina also has had some pretty important pieces come in too. Maybe some bigger pieces than we've seen before than Beamer got there, or at least in a 10-year break between him and the previous South Carolina Spurrier teams.
You know, last year was not a great year for them, you know, and Rattler's actually a guy outside of the top batch of quarterbacks. He's the one other quarterback that NFL coaches seem to be very intrigued by. Mm-hmm. Again, they lost some good players to the NFL. I don't know. I think for them, if you get to a bowl game, that's good. When you look at the start, they got to go to Kentucky. Then you have LSU. It's, I don't know. I'm looking at the schedule right now. I feel like you have a handful of toss-up games, but at Kentucky, that's a maybe game. LSU comes there. I think probably lose that. Ole Miss comes there. Probably lose that. Got to go to Alabama. Probably lose that. I mean, got to go to Oklahoma. Probably lose that. Then you get A&M. You know, it's like A&M, Missouri is home, you know, for them. And then Clemson is home. I don't know. If you get to six wins, I think that's optimistic.
And then lastly, A&M. I didn't know that Purdue was the dream team of transfer goldmine prospects, but Nick Scorton was one of the best defensive linemen in the Big Ten last year. He had 2.5 sacks in the spring game. Obviously, Texas A&M lost some pieces in the portal, but their defensive line should be really good. Connor Wegman.
He's from that. Like I talked to Nick, a bunch in the process this offseason. He's he grew up right there, so it's not a shock that A&M was able to land him, but
it's more of a shock that maybe one of the best defenders and one of the best receivers in college football this year both left Purdue. And maybe I'm getting over my skis. I tend to do that a little bit, but like I get excited about, you know, the proposition of what Oklahoma and Texas A&M could do for new starts for these guys. And mm-hmm. I'm curious, obviously A&M has had some pretty rough transitional periods, you know, with the Jimbo Fisher stuff. What do you think are realistic expectations for Mike Elko? And, you know, is this kind of like the first year of righting the ship, or do you think they should be really good out of the gate?
I think it's the first year for writing the ship. I mean, you had Jimbo in that celebrated class of supposedly the highest ranked recruiting class of all time. Yeah. And it's a shell right now. Almost none of them are there. So, you know, infrastructure wise, I think he's really starting over. You know, he knows the place, and that I think counts for something. But, you know, you have a couple of rebuilds in this conference. Certainly Auburn was one of them in the same division. I don't know. I look at them and say, you know, if you can somehow get to 8 wins at Texas A&M this year, considering, you know, when you have a coach who was, you know, or is just kind of reeling of transfer portal and recruiting misses, and, you know, I don't know. I just think it's like, okay, let's build the locker room and develop it that way. Like, the good news is Elko did a terrific job at Duke, and he's been there before, so he has an understanding of the place. You know, I don't think that was like a bad hire. It wasn't a great cycle, you know, for them, but I think you're taking a defensive guy. This is a place that has a lot of pride in, you know, its defense and its defensive legacy. And I think he can kind of galvanize that.
All right. We're almost done here. Do you want to do some mailbag questions with me? I think you're going to get a kick out of one of them. All right. Let's first start. And I want to thank you guys. I've been promising mailbag questions for 3 weeks, and we keep running out of time. And I could talk to, I didn't even get to ask Bruce about Bo Nix, because I think he's fascinating. But you're going to come back like 5 more times this week, you said?
Absolutely. All right.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to, it's the olive branch of the olive.
Doesn't mean I had anything to do with it.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. I feel like I'm back. Am I not back?
I hope so.
I think I've been on once since the ban. So Stu, he's crafty. I don't know. You never knew what Stu's doing back there, but thank you guys for your patience. This is from KDC. What game should I absolutely clear my schedule for, or put a big block on my calendar for next year in terms of pure absurd entertainment value? And I know that I sprung this on you, so if you want me to go first, I will, but I have my game.
I will give you one. I think. And it's an obvious one, though.
Mine's an obvious one.
Michigan has beaten the school used to cover 3 years in a row.
Okay.
That game is going to be in your old stomping grounds. I'm sure you have had many a wild night at Buffalo Wild Wings there.
That was my date spot.
Okay. This should be the payback year for Ryan Day.
Can you imagine if they lost?
I actually can't. I think this is the year they will remedy that. But if they lost that game, though,
that would be like post-apocalyptic city in terms of like tires on fire in the street.
I could not. Like, one of the most memorable games I've ever been at was 2 years ago now in Columbus. It was the payback game. And I was on the sideline with my colleague, Tom Rinaldi. At one point, I turned to Tom in the fourth quarter. I was like, just turn around and look. We were behind the Michigan bench, and you could just see the faces of shock and disgust and disbelief. And I can't imagine that it would be this way, that way again. But like, I love this rivalry so much. And again, full disclosure, I work for Fox, and that's the biggest game of the year for us. But to me, it is like everything that feels like big time college football. You know, it's fall weather. It's, you know, like, it's just tradition overload. It's two schools that really don't like each other at all. Coaching staffs that don't seem to like each other. Now you have Tony Alford on the other sideline. I don't think that's going to change, you know, the dynamic of.
It's just another sliver, though.
Yeah. And there's just so much great stuff there. I get it. There'll be games that'll probably have like, we're just talking about Michigan, maybe an 8-4 team. You know, there'll probably be a game that's a 1-4 game or something. But like, for me, because the playoff is what the playoff's going to be, like, I just want the drama that's going to be around the game, you know, like that. And I do think Michigan's going to be good enough on defense, especially on the D-line, where I think they will have a lot of tight games.
Mine, I'll bookend it because you're at the end of the season. Mine's at the beginning, August 31st, when Miami goes to Florida. I don't know if it's just because I'm missing football, but like the loser of that game, like someone's going to lose.
The loser leaves town match like they used to have in pro wrestling.
I mean, it kind of feels like whoever loses the game is just going to be in complete and utter hell. Like, I can't imagine, you know, it's an in-state rivalry for, you know, so that, you know, in and of itself, it's not Florida State, Florida or whatever, but it's still.
I feel like the Miami people would take that even worse than the Florida fans. Cause I feel like to some degree, a lot of Florida fans were already checked out on it, you know, after last year, whereas,
yeah.
You know, you got Cam Ward. I suspect they will add a couple of big time transfers now before the start of the season. You still have a really good young offensive line that's been built. I mean, it's not, I don't think Miami's a top five team, but I do think Miami has a real shot to make the playoff and not just make it, you know, if they keep developing, like I could see them being a team that could make a little noise in the playoff.
It's a big year for Cristobal there. I mean, if they go 7-5 again, it's like, what are we doing?
Yeah, I think I don't think Mario's on the hot seat. They've spent too much money mm-hmm. on him, and I just don't think they're going to look and go, oh, yeah, Mario didn't work out, so now we're going to, after 3 years, we're pulling the plug and we're going to hire this guy. I don't think there's any of that, but I think their expectations are going to build, and they're going to build a lot. And I think, you know, I think people would be disappointed if they beat Florida 21-20. You know, I think that's, to me, that feels like a chance for Miami to make a statement of where they're going to be. But I'm with you. I mean, you mentioned it. It's an August game. I'm excited for it.
Yep. Okay. Next one from Brandon O. Is it time to admit Colorado's team building strategy is not sustainable? Or do we have to keep pretending that going 4-8 is the greatest coaching accomplishment ever? They did add important pieces in the portal this week. Defensive end Deion Hayes from Pitt. Who left Pitt, funny enough, and said the reason why is because he wanted to compete for championships. And then he transferred to Colorado. That had people raising their eyebrows a little bit over the weekend. And the question's there, but I haven't asked you. I've been pretty strong in my opinions of Colorado. Like, what is your take on their roster building, Deion, everything? Like, where do you stand on this whole thing?
I think it's a team that was a horrible one-win team before he took over. They went to 4 wins. You know, they ran out of gas, you know, in October, it felt like. But they still have what I think is a first-round quarterback. They have some playmakers. They've definitely upgraded in the trenches. They go into the Big 12. I would say, like, you know, can they win 9 games? That wouldn't shock me. I don't think that, like, you can say, oh, the roster, you know, his roster built, like, what, who goes to Colorado? It's Colorado, right? This program has not been relevant for 20 years. Who goes there and takes over what he took over? And it's like, is going to flip it any faster? You know, like, I'm not saying everything he's done, I would say, oh yeah, that turned out to be the best move ever. But a lot of it has worked. Again, I mean, you know, it's like they were so bad. I think people are forgetting how bad they were. They're sick of the hype. You know, it's just, no, look, if they go 5-7 this year, then I'm like, okay, then I'll say, you know, we overplayed that hand. But if they get to 8-9 wins, and I think they can do that. They played the team that came out of the Big 12. They weren't the Big 12 champs the year before, but they played for a national title game. And they beat TCU on the road. You know, it wasn't like it was all fluky. I mean, they had some good players. They just didn't have enough in the trenches. And that's a hard thing to, like, if you have nothing, that's a hard thing to build up from. You know, I think people tend to forget, like, just, like, how bad the program was. But we talked about Florida State a little bit ago. And, you know, like they're when Jimbo left, they were terrible on the offensive line, just terrible. Now, Colorado was probably even worse. But so when they got, after Jimbo left, they go 5-7, 6-7, 3-6. You know, like that's not far from 4-8. And Jimbo's teams were like, there was no one win season there. You know, this program had to be built from scratch, and that takes time.
Yeah. It's an interesting thought, you know, because it's like on one hand, it's impossible to ignore that they are in a much better place, at least on the field, than they were before he got there. But my number one thing with Deion always has been that there's so much potential there from him from a stardom standpoint, and the reason why he's qualified for that job to begin with. The fact that he's not doing any high school recruiting to lay the foundation of the future is alarming to me. But if you think that this is just going to be a portal program, then I guess that could be the case. I just don't think that any of his behavior
he's gotten a couple of five-star guys. You know, he got McLean 2 years ago. He obviously got Seton this past year at a position of need. But yeah. I think it's hard if you're going to like try to flip a program fast. You can't do that just by taking high school recruits. You got to go hard in the portal. You'd be like, I mean, you'd be Dabo, like, if you're not going heavy, unless, you know, if you really plan on doing that. And the other thing you got to also factor in is, I don't know if their NIL, you know, bandwidth is like it is at some of the other programs you may be competing with for that.
Yeah.
I don't think it's the operation Oregon has, let's put it that way.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, I agree with everything you're saying. I feel like there is just a level of effort there that isn't, you know, being illustrated in the sense that, you know, even if they can only take 9 or 10 high school signees a year, it's like, go to a high school for God's sakes. You know what I mean? Like it kind of blows my mind, but we'll see where he is in a year and a half. Maybe I'll be totally wrong about him. Okay. Here's another one. From Chad P, can you give us a reason why fans of college sports should financially support our team's NIL if players are going to have no connection or loyalty to the schools? And when your NIL tells you they are fundraising to keep up with other programs, those schools are just going to follow suit and raise more money for their collectives in response to stay competitive, creating a never-ending race to build an even bigger war chest. If all teams have to do is flash their cash to entice all the best talents in the world to come play for the team, that would substantially diminish the product on the field. Taking all this into consideration, it seems like a hard ass to expect fans to fund player talent, adding yet another layer of financial strain on our shoulders, who are already investing heavily in supporting their teams through increased ticket and app costs.
It's a fair point he makes. I would never want to say to somebody, yeah, you should throw around, like, it doesn't cost that much. Like, I would, if anybody says, like, oh, I don't want to read this story on The Athletic, I'm like, that's a cup of coffee. You know, you buy somebody a cup of coffee in NIL, you're not moving the needle.
Yeah.
I get it. It's like, I think that is a tough ask. You're asking people who might not be boosters to turn into boosters, you know? And I don't know like how that works, you know, because I see this out here, you know, at UCLA, you know, like where people are like, oh, there's no, and then, you know, they had a coaching change and people were expecting all of a sudden like it to be like the coffers to just fill up with cash, and it doesn't always work that way. You know, I think it is I get where he's coming from, and I don't have a good answer for that, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's just a rational thought. And, you know, the hardest part about this is that, you know, fans indirectly are responsible for the talent and the money and the war chests in professional sports. They just use it, that money and, you know, ticket costs and apparel sales and stuff. I think it's harder in college when there's another stack of cash that's just laying in the corner there that the players aren't touching, that has nothing to do with any of the things that you guys buy, that you're just like, take that money. Like, I would have a hard time with that. If you don't want to donate to a collective because of that, like, I am not going to argue with it. I don't think if I were a fan, I would donate to a collective. That's just my 2 cents. But also too, if you love your team and you have an extra $50 or $100 or whatever you want to give a month and you feel more connected to your program, that's your prerogative as well. But yes, I do think that it's very weird and unfortunate that the fans have had to pay the brunt of stacking those war chests in order to pay the talent, especially when the talent leaves regularly. Okay. Thanks, Bruce.
Personal question off that.
Yeah, go ahead.
What team are you most invested in?
The team I bet on that day.
Okay. There's no team you passionately care about in a sport. Mm. It could be a pro sport. It could be, no.
No, not really. Do you have one?
I had some, you know, but yeah.
I mean, when I was a kid, I had teams. But like I feel like as much as I got invested into this business, like my interaction with like sitting down with a foam finger just didn't hit the same way as it might for other people. But that said, I enjoy fantasy football, so I love the NFL, and I enjoy placing a wager every now and then. So, and that was another question that we had from somebody disagreeing with the notion that betting on the game enhances the viewing experience. I don't know what your take is on that. I don't even know if it's legal in California, but it is just kind of been my way of connecting to it. But who were your teams growing up?
I was a Steelers fan growing up. I was also a big New Jersey Nets fan, which is going to be really weird. But like, I used to go to like 6 or 7 games a year. And that was big. But then once I got into, especially work now, it's like, I kind of want to see people I know do well. You know, like Ed Reed was always really good to me. I rooted for the Ravens when he got to the NFL. Patrick Willis, I rooted to see him do really well. You know, and then it's like kind of gone from there. You know, so
yeah,
you just kind of like, if there's somebody you have a connection to, I feel like you end up pulling for them. You know, maybe not necessarily just their team, but how they do.
Thank you to the legend Bruce Feldman for joining the show. It's always a huge feather in our cap whenever we can have somebody who has been around college football and reported at such a high level for as many years as he has. Thank you guys for listening to the latest edition of Until Saturday. Go listen to the Audible with Stu and Bruce if you want to hear more from him. You'll be hearing more from us later in the week. We'll be talking about the NFL draft, more comings and goings in the portal, and whatever pops up in this crazy sport that we all love. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch you guys later in the week.